Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
This week on RealityCast, we'll have an interview with Nixonland author Rick Perlstein. Also, a segment on the right of doctors to refuse treatment, why George Will has no empathy, and a review of anti-choice songs. I promise the review will be more funny than painful. I'll admit, I'm fascinated by the Christian version of sex advice books. You know, the ones that are strictly for married couples? There's a recent one that sounds almost kind of nightmarish.
Let's say you and your spouse have not had sex in so long that you can't remember the last time you did. Not the day, not the month, not even the season.
Yo.
The Millers of North Carolina decided to do something about it. To reinvigorate their marriage, they made a promise. We will make love every day for the next 365 days in a row.
I'm honestly not surprised that a lot of evangelical couples find it's hard to ignite the passion. It's too much pressure to be utterly celibate before marriage and then turn it up to 11 after the wedding. This immoderate solution will probably have the same problems. Meanwhile, we heathens have perversely learned the value of moderation. This segment demonstrates why I find religious arguments endlessly frustrating. Religion turns into this get-out-of-jail-free card that's denied to non-religious people in so many ways. Like the issue of refusing to give medical care to someone. Not that you find doctors doing something like refusing to treat prostate cancer and anti-choice men on the grounds that they should learn that gender is destiny. But if doctors are going to hide behind religion, I'd like to see other, more rational doctors have equal rights to just make up the rules as they go along themselves. On June 10th on CNN, American Morning had their legal analysis Sunny Hostin on to talk about doctors refusing treatment to patients on bigoted, religious grounds.
You know, I think the short answer, Kira, is that it is legal and that it's been happening for a very long time. This is a debate that's been going on in the medical profession. It's been going on in the legal community. And the bottom line is doctors feel very strongly that they are allowed on firm moral grounds to really refuse treatment. And 16 states now allow doctors to refuse sterilization. 46 states have laws that allow doctors to refuse to perform abortions. And so there are many, many cases now that are at the forefront. Men are being refused vasectomies at Catholic hospitals. Rape victims are being refused the morning after pill. Lesbians are being refused IVF treatment. And so the question is a patient's rights or a doctor's right to freedom of religion.
I don't know if it should be framed as a freedom of religion issue, because that calls into question how many other bigots out there can start claiming God told them to mistreat entire classes of people. Pharmacists are already hiding behind freedom of religion to deny basic services to people they have prejudices against. Sexually active women and gays are the two major classes of people that Jesus gives these pharmacists permission to hate. But what if some pharmacist has a revelation that, say, Jesus doesn't want him dispensing drugs to black people? There's a whole can of worms when you use freedom of religion as a cover for bigotry. That said, I think doctors should have a general right to refuse patients, but should be obligated legally to disclose their prejudices up front. Doctors are special because the service they provide is so personal that it's just important that the doctor is a good fit for the patient. If a doctor can't be fair to a patient, then it's in the patient's best interest that this be disclosed so she can go to a doctor that will fight for her.
New England Journal of Medicine study in 2007 really proved that. If you look, 63% say it's okay to tell patients about their moral objections. 18% felt no obligation whatsoever to refer patients elsewhere. And one distinction that I think is important that some of the doctors that I spoke to said, emergency care is one thing. We are going to save lives, as is our oath. But these elective procedures in office, we have no requirement to do that. So I think it's a case that we should be watching, but I think that patients need to ask their doctors what their beliefs are when they're seeking treatment, because they may not get the treatment that they want.
Good advice, but I think it should go a step further. Patients are often, and for good reasons, intimidated by doctors. Doctors should own the responsibility to inform the patients up front, perhaps in a sheet that you sign with all your other paperwork. Just something that says X, Y, and Z are things I won't do for you. So if that's what you need, go elsewhere. Interestingly, doctors who provide abortion are all up on this responsibility, really creating a model for other doctors. A lot of good abortion providers have counseling sessions ahead of time to outline what will and won't be happening in their care. That should be the industry standard, I think. I'd like to welcome Rick Perlstein to the show. Rick is a historian and the author of the recent book, Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. He's here today to talk about the left-right culture war split that's defined American politics since the 60s. Welcome to RealityCast, Rick.
I'm thrilled to be here, Amanda.
One thing I found interesting about the culture war split is that in Nixon's day, the big issues were law and order and busing, and those have been eclipsed by reproductive rights and gay rights in our day. But the battle lines between right and left stay roughly the same. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think a lot of actually the battle lines were driven then, as they are now, over questions of sexuality. Sexuality could often be the issue behind something like busing. I mean, the idea that they were going to bus these black boys into our neighborhood and they were going to date our daughters was very much kind of the unspoken fear of people who were terrified of the notion of integration and busing. Law and order was deeply sexualized too, the idea that we had to, you know, kind of protect our women folk and things like that. So, you know, there's this really weird kind of psychosexual base behind just an enormous amount of backlash politics. I mean, sometimes I thought I was writing a book about America's sexual neuroses.
I was impressed at the parts of the book where you saw like the explicit racial sexual like fears put out in flyers and stuff. Can you speak to that a little bit more?
Sure. When the marchers marched through Selma in March of 1963, the blogger Digby actually told me about a pamphlet that she remembers being passed around when she was growing up in the South about the marchers, the dogs being driven rabid by the marchers' sex smell. I mean, this is the sense that there's a sexualized threat underneath every kind of political irregularity, whether it's right-wingers describing left-wingers or even left-wingers describing right-wingers. I mean, one of my favorite examples is when the anti-war activists were taking over the buildings at Columbia University. And one of the anti-war leaders says, well, the cops are so neurotic, so you girls should just pull up your shirts, and the cops won't know what to do, and they'll go nuts because they're just, you know, so screwed up. Everyone was kind of accusing everyone else of not being quite right sexually.
And that played into the aftermath of the Kent State shootings, too, right?
Sure. The students who were protesting before the Kent State shootings, actually, would do things like they would look at the nameplates on the National Guardsmen's chests, get their names, call their wives in Akron, and say, "Oh, well, your husband is screwing around with me here on the Kent State campus." You know, this kind of sexual taunting was just a part of every side of the culture war in the 1960s. It's a little more explicit now because we're literally arguing over debates about sexuality in the public sphere, but there are plenty of those debates too over things like sex education and whether Woodstock was a good thing or a horrifying thing.
Much of the book focuses on, for lack of a better term, PR mistakes progressives made in the 60s and how Nixon exploited them. Why did they screw up so badly?
Well, the word I use is blindsided. Liberals just kept on being blindsided by the reaction of kind of ordinary middle American, middle class, often white citizens to social changes that they just saw as kind of natural and inevitable. It happens again and again. You know, Mayor Lindsay, who was one of the most kind of arrogant and out of touch liberals in the book, would set up a civilian complaint review commission in New York to oversee the police. And just, you know, everyone went nuts. And the liberals were just so shocked at this that, you know, it seemed so logical. It seemed so supported by the research and things like that. And it really was a consequence of a certain kind of liberal hubris that I think the left has done a really good job working through. I mean, before we think of any reform these days, we do a lot better job of asking ourselves, what kind of existential anxieties will this reform bring up? And they did a terrible job of that in the 1960s. All kinds of really kind of fundamental social changes were kind of visited upon people by what Kevin Phillips, the Nixon aide who later became something of a liberal political commentator, called the Toryhood of change. This idea that change was being instituted on people from above without their consent by liberal bureaucrats. It wasn't entirely a made-up charge.
Well, and you hear the echoes of it nowadays in the term activist judges.
Right, but it doesn't signify nearly as logically as it did in the 1960s. I mean, one of the points of the book is that when I say we're living in Nixon land still, people still use the language that were forged in these battles to describe today's political realities, even though the passions on the ground just aren't nearly as great. I mean, in the 60s, we're talking about literally people shooting each other, you know, people bombing each other, you know, on both sides of the political divide. But we're still using the same kind of language about, you know, the Toryhood of change, you know, even though there's just no one around in the politics today like John Lindsay. The Republicans would like to pretend that they do, that there are, but it kind of shows how kind of out of touch they are with what people seem really concerned about these days.
Some of the book focuses on the first wave of the anti-sex ed, anti-choice movement, which of course directly relates to the focus of this program. Do you have advice for reproductive rights activists in pushing our agenda after what you've learned?
It's a tricky business because the people who pushed, I don't even want to say pushed, the people who introduced sex ed into the schools in the late 60s were not dummies when it came to public relations. They did it in conjunction with schools. They did it in conjunction with the clergy. In fact, Mary Calderon, one of the founders of the sex education movement, basically came up with the idea at a religious conference, at a conference of ministers. So they laid the groundwork. But what they didn't do was understand that people would see sex education as an imposition on sort of what families were supposed to do. And I'm not sure how you get around that. I think it's a difficult negotiation. I think you have to kind of disarm your critics before they come about, bring them on board, get them to buy in, and politically neutralize them that way. But the sex educators in the 60s tried to do that too. And there still was an enormous backlash. It's no small matter. I don't have any easy answers.
Well, and the abortion rights movement, I'm sure, felt a little bit more like it was just pushed on people.
Yes,
at the time.
I think so. I read about how Time Magazine, especially, which is kind of a character in the book, because Time Magazine was kind of like this middle-brow journal that kind of saw itself as explaining to Americans what was respectable opinion. And basically, when it started writing about abortion, liberalization of abortion in the early 60s, it took it as a self-evident good. And every time they did that, they get these letters to the editor just kind of shocked. And you could tell that the editors at Time just didn't think that they were saying anything controversial. They literally were blindsided by the controversy over abortion. And, of course, we wouldn't be, no liberal would be blindsided by controversy over abortion now. So it's a, you know, much healthier political situation. Abortion was just kind of seen as, in the context of science and the overpopulation crisis. And there's this astonishing article about birth control they put the pill on the cover of Time magazine in 1967, and they only talked about the opposition to birth control like in this tiny little sentence, like three quarters of the way through the article. I mean, they really didn't even consider it as a pressing concern.
What mistakes do you think that liberals made then that we're still kind of making now?
Well, I think we do a lot better job. That said, you know, every time a liberal condescends to a conservative and basically kind of goes into the argument presuming that they're stupider than we are, kind of a new conservative gets their wings. Now, it's tricky because, as you've pointed out, a lot of the things that conservatives believe, you know, are stupid. You know, the idea that, you know, evolution is some kind of secular imposition on the order of nature, right, or something like denying global warming. But at the same time, I think if you come at these political questions asking where people are coming from existentially, asking where people are, where the anxieties about these kinds of intellectual formations are coming from, and if you come at them with empathy, you can be a pretty tough customer. After all, I do write a blog called The Big Con, while still treating your adversaries in a way that they won't see as patronizing. It's a difficult balance, though.
The author is Rick Perlstein, and the book is called Nixonland. It's available at pretty much any bookstore you care to visit. Thank you so much for coming on to RealityCast, Rick.
Thank you, Amanda.
Now listen up. Now gather around. Now listen up.
Daniel Radosh, the author of Rapture Ready, was recently on Reason TV talking about the weird world of Christian pop culture.
Why just walk along the beach when you can walk along the beach wearing sandals that imprint the words "Follow Jesus" in the sand behind you? American evangelicalism has always been about taking faith out of the churches and into the culture. And the early revival meetings were really entertainment and spectacle.
Oh, I know all about fundy Christian pop culture. At least one area of it, which is the anti-choice industry. There's cartoons where fetuses loll around and oversized uteruses that look like apartments. There's little necklaces shaped like tiny feet. And you can have tiny feet stamped on your check so as better to terrorize hapless bank tellers with the knowledge that you oppose their basic human rights. At least if they're female. But one thing that never stops puzzling me is the huge numbers of maudlin songs about how terrible abortion is. I've played a couple on this show before. I played a country western song last week about the Colorado Ballot Initiative to define fertilized eggs as persons. But I've never done an overview. And now, without further ado, I shall. The first category, and possibly my favorite, are the songs sung from the perspective of the fetuses themselves. Like this one called Deliver Me by Marie Morrison.
I can't talk, I can't cry. Will you please speak for me? I want a chance to live my life. Will you deliver me?
This pretty much hits all the themes. First of all, it's imperative that the talking fetus be male. If there are singing fetuses out there that are female, I haven't heard any of them. I'm not doubting that there's one or two, but the main thing here is that by pretending to be the fetus itself, a man takes on this authority to berate women and tell them what to do. That's kind of unseemly otherwise. The singing male fetus genre hit new heights when Nick Cannon released a song a few years ago called Can I Live? That was all up on the Total Request Live hit parade.
$300, that's the price of living.
What?
Mommy, I don't like this clinic. Hopefully you make the right decision. Yeah. And don't go through with the knife incision. But it's hard to make the right move when you were high school. Now you gotta work all day and take night school. Hopping off the bus and the rain is pouring. What you want, morning sickness or the sickness of morning?
The video is from Can I Ball Productions. He also has a video for a song called Dime Piece, where a variety of women are sized up as potential stalker, old school freak, emotionally unstable, and in a great act of hypocrisy, one is blown off for having too many baby daddies. Luckily, there are no singing fetuses in that, because who knows what kind of things they'd say. Another category of anti-choice songwriting is similar in the sense that it's still about being self-absorbed, and of course treats women like second-class people. These are songs that flatter the listener by telling them that they're a unique snowflake, and suggest that abortion rights are a direct assault on that. One in a Billion Choices by Lawrence and Diane Marie Leach fits this bill.
You are one in a billion choices, and God chosen you. So stop, look, and listen to the beauty of your name. As she struggles with the questions of life, a baby is on the way.
You can guess what the Lord is going to say, since the Lord says whatever the songwriters want him to say. And of course, the genre of anti-choice songs would be incomplete without Christian heavy metal. Oh yeah, Satan's music brought to bear for the Lord's work in oppressing women. Here's Holy Soldier singing as the fetus, of course, in their song See No Evil. Usually the lyric, Mother, I'm Coming Soon, means something entirely different in heavy metal songs. If you come across anti-choice songs that make you scream for mercy because of the suckitude, please email them to me at amanda.marcotte@gmail.com. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts. George Will edition.
The women voters as a group who vote Democrat tend to be pro-choice. It's a poor choice of words, but it means they believe ultimately the woman gets to decide whether to have abortion or not, not the state. How can John McCain appeal to that point of view?
You mean those are women who believe in the words of Barack Obama that they shouldn't be punished for the baby?
Right. Got another infelicitous comment, right. Yes.
First of all, Obama's comment was made in reference to sex education, not abortion. But the general point is the same, I'll grant you. What I don't get is why these men think it's so ridiculous for women to think that being punished with a baby should be a bad thing. What part is foolish? The part where we don't think babies should be a punishment? The part where we think that babies should be wanted and a joy? The part where we think it's unfair to be punished for sex while men get off scot-free? I'm thinking that's the part Chris Matthews and George Will think is so hilarious. Oh, those silly ladies and their belief that they should have the same rights as men to own their bodies and sexuality.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.